Good morning.
Good morning.
You're Mr. Buchholz?
I am.
Okay. And Ms. Wood is here in the courtroom. We've talked with her briefly. She understands she has no argument this morning. So you, on behalf of appellant, Mr. Buchholz, as you know, will have 15 minutes for your argument in chief. No rebuttal time, since there is no argument to rebut. And we're ready to begin when you are.
May it please the court, Attorney Jacob Buchholz here representing appellant Mr. Brad Wood. We're here on essentially one issue with several components, and that is that the district court erred in awarding $2,700 a month in spousal maintenance to Ms. Wood. Primary issue that I believe requires mandatory reversal is the court's admission and acknowledgement that it used gross incomes. They use gross incomes, which is a clear violation of the law. The court suggested that it did so because it didn't have adequate evidence. Appellant Mr. Wood, through myself, brought a motion for amended findings, which I believe is the proper method to bring errors to the court's attention and point out exactly why, within the record, even the record as it stood, had adequate information for the district court to make conclusions and findings regarding net income. Number one, net income can simply be calculated using pay stubs. That estimates income.
As I understood what the district court did, it said that it couldn't determine, based on the record, what the net income of the imputed income to the then petitioner would have been, and so therefore I will use gross for both. So the question of whether it could have looked at your client's income is, I don't know that it rejected that. Instead, it said, I'll use gross for both because of the problem with the petitioner's income. Am I wrong about that? I mean, is that the reasoning?
It's hard to say what Judge Knutson really decided in the.
I mean, didn't he explain it that way?
That was one of his points.
Okay.
And I think the memorandum for attached to the motion for amended findings essentially points out that there just isn't adequate evidence in the record. I don't know if it's clearly differentiated that it couldn't have been calculated for Mr. Wood as explicitly as it was for the imputed income. I don't know.
Well, I mean, in the factual finding 17 and addendum 71 says, based on the information provided by the parties, the court is unable to calculate the anticipated net income of petitioner for purposes of determining maintenance. In lieu of using net income, the court therefore finds it's equitable to use the party's gross incomes.
That is the factual.
Okay.
Either way, he didn't calculate it for Mr. Wood. So whether or not his reasoning was for one or the other, I brought the issue back to Judge Knutson and said, no, there's a ways to calculate that. Even estimating it, reading the case law, including published and unpublished opinions, suggests that if the court attempts and gets close, it's probably good enough. But right now, as the record stands, there isn't anything for this court to consider regarding net income. The pay stubs.
And did the petitioner put in any evidence of what her net income would be for the imputed income?
No.
Is there anything in the record?
I don't believe there was. Nothing was provided. Neither party provided a CPA or breakdowns or additional evidence. Mr. Wood, through myself, brought in a vocational rehabilitation. Jennifer Bay, I believe, was her testimony and her name. But she's not maybe she could have attempted to make tax treatments. But I think the point is.
But she did not.
Whether or not it could or could not have been, it wasn't done. And it needs to be reversed for findings for the court to make those conclusions at approximately $2,800 for the petitioner. And I provided ad nauseum my estimations of what I can perceive to be the error. The error is vast and significant, and Mr. Wood has $4,000 of net available income approximately according to his pre-dissolution pay stubs in the spring of 2017 before alimony. What that means is that he cannot meet his budget that the court granted him of approximately $4,600. So on its face, the respondent, appellant Mr. Wood, cannot meet his monthly budget on his net income. So from an error standpoint, the other piece of it, of course, is that their taxes aren't considered as well. That's just error upon error. From the error standpoint is that if, you know, net income should presumably take care of the net income element, but it also would presumptively deal with the issue of the alimony and the tax impact of alimony. As this court probably knows, all the orders pre-2018 that were issued as should apply in this case would mean that it's tax deductible for Mr. Wood and taxable as income, which again exemplifies the error and the concern. So next issue, because there is gross incomes were used, there was error, and we need additional findings on the amount. The next element is income available. I understand that the court could not address any of my additional arguments and just simply remand, but I'm asking this court specifically to deal with additional issues because I believe Judge Knudsen refused to look at them in determining maintenance, so I don't want there to be a second appeal, if possible. That issue being income available to the parties, specifically to petitioner Ms. Wood. That being, and I address this both in the district court and the motion for amended findings, and that is the issue of the pension, the house, proceeds, the 401k money. The Curtis decision, I believe, makes very clear, and this is all post Levy Lee, post all the other citations in the court's order and memorandum. It cites the Curtis decision, but makes no mention in its memorandum, specifically on the issue of Curtis. It was, I believe, a strategic decision by trial counsel to seek a lump sum payout of the pension. And I think the Curtis decision, what I'll consider end run around the issue of Levy Lee. Levy Lee says pension payments are income for purposes of maintenance. But if you take it as a cash settlement, perhaps, then it's a property settlement and we don't consider it income that's available. The Curtis decision makes clear that assets available are income. So I asked myself, as trial counsel, asked Ms. Wood, and I cited that.
Interest on the assets available.
Correct. Income produced by the assets.
Yes.
As makes clear. And that's all we're issuing, not to invade the property settlement and not to seek a redivision, but that money of what would have been available to Ms. Wood via the pension and then what she'd expects to receive, because no financial analyst was.
So is it a lump sum? I'm sorry,
yes.
I didn't understand that from there. It's a lump sum.
That was the award.
That's to be, and you're saying when that's given, there will be income produced on it? And that's what should be considered?
Yes. The amount is $166,000. The trial court testimony in record by Ms. Wood, I said, why do you want the lump sum? It was a last-minute strategy. Her trial counsel asked her, well, do you want this in a lump sum or do you want the pension? And surprise to me, because we had been through many mediation sessions, that was going to be the issue, again, her decision, I asked Ms. Wood and said, what amount do you expect to receive in terms of your investment? Why avoid cash in hand, guaranteed for life with a pension, versus risking it in the stock market? Ms. Wood is a stay-at-home, and for a long period of time, she's not a financial expert, so I asked her that question. And upon advice, her testimony was upon the advice of her financial advisor, she would be making between 8 and 12%. So I provided those calculations based on the only testimony in the record on that issue is her expected income. Now, I don't know what she would actually receive, and I've had several arguments with district court judges as to what is a reasonable amount expected to receive. That was partially in the Curtis decision. Is it 2%, 4%, 7%? And again, Curtis somewhat deals with we can't reallocate assets to get a higher return. There's no allocation.
So this is, and you talked about the pension, a 401k, and the house proceeds,
yes.
I think, and now we've just talked about the pension.
Yep.
Can you speak to the other two?
The pension's 150, excuse me, 401k division for Mr. Wood is 154,000. I'll skip the dollars. The pension is approximately 166,000, divided as a lump sum from the date of valuation. The house is approximately 55,000, and her own 401k awarded to her is about 24,000, about $399,000, $400,000. Not in dispute, the parties received the amounts they did, but that $400,000, if you were to do just some basic estimations of simple interest invested in a CD at a few percent, yields substantial income. without invading principle. And that was essentially ignored by the district court in its entirety. Now, it's my position to this court that the court should have awarded the pension income to her, but understandably, the position now is that money has to be dealt with on remand, that available income on the interest or the assets awarded. So I'm asking the court to direct the court to consider that in its findings. Otherwise, I'm afraid the district court will just ignore it, saying it wasn't dealt with on appeal, we're not going to revisit the issue, I denied it, et cetera. Lack of findings on monthly expenses. Again, another direction on remand. I'm asking this court, there was substantial difference on monthly expenses. Ms. Wood claimed $8,000 or so on her monthly expenses. That was reduced to approximately $5,826. Mr. Wood's over $5,000 budget was reduced to $4,600. It's important to note that the parties' combined gross available marital income for the highest years they've ever had, according to the tax returns and the documents, was never as high. And that's unfortunately probably true for most marriages, that once they get to the divorce proceedings, their budgets go up. You separate, you have two households. I'm not ignorant to that fact. However, when you go from an $8,000 claim budget and a $5,500 claim budget, that's a net available claimed income of $13,500 a month, which never was available. What that means is the monthly expenses are inflated, the district court agreed and reduced specifically estimated expenses by Ms. Wood. What I'm asking for this court is the court to be specific. The household budget claim was $2,920. The marital home principal interest taxes and insurance that they'd always lived in was about $1,300 to $1,500 a month, double. And the court.
So you're asking us to go in and substitute a figure for what Judge Knudsen found?
No, just tell Judge Knudsen what he did. Tell him to make more findings. He reduced that, but didn't say why. He didn't say which categories he reduced and why. I'm just asking the court on remand to tell in its findings, if we have to do a second appeal, what parts of the budget did you reduce by what? For example, the medical insurance and acclaimed medical expenses were almost $2,100 in acclaimed expenses a month by Ms. Wood. The judge said they're inflated or I'm reducing them, but didn't know what.
Does the case law require a district court judge to explain the amount of reductions and the basis for reductions?
Clearly, no. But what it does clearly say is that appellate review has to have adequate findings.
And then we review that reduction for an abuse of discretion?
Yes. And almost always the court upholds findings on budgets, but it has to have something to review. The problem is we have nothing to review. We have a reduction. To be fair to Ms. Wood, she had her budget reduced by $2,200 for no reason. And I can't tell this court exactly why. I can make my same arguments that Judge Knudsen in the district court said I made my decision. But again, for appellate review, there has to be some adequate findings. And that's simply what I'm requesting is that if the expenses are what they are, the end result is why is Ms. Wood's budget $1,200 higher than Mr. Wood's, especially when the district court indicates that I'm not including speculative medical costs. It's important to note that when you look at the record, Ms. Wood was in a very unique position, and on remand it'll be interesting. What that means is that she was unemployed temporarily due to a job layoff in the middle of the divorce. So when we come to trial, she's seeking employment. She used to have insurance, used to have all these things in place, and we come to trial with a very empty record, let's say that. And so she's in the process of living at friends' homes and unidentified addresses and makes a claim to live in a $250,000 home in the cities as her potential purchase. None of that's ever happened. The home was never purchased. She had never moved. To this date, I don't know any of that's true. None of that was developed in the record. All of these expenses were speculative. Her medical insurance had not been yet taken out. So from a record on appellate review, she had no documented expenses on the medical insurance. So even though Judge Knudsen states that those are findings in the record, they weren't disputed by Mr. Wood. We had nothing to dispute. There wasn't a single bill of medical insurance. Well, I take that back. There was a medical insurance claim, a statement of the amount at trial, but she had never actually taken the insurance out. She was available potentially for Minnesota Care or medical assistance, and she had no outstanding actual medical debt at the time. So again, $2,100 in claimed medical insurance and bills that were not substantiated at trial, a $3,000 housing budget that was not substantiated at trial. That alone is almost $3,000 of her budget that is in excess. I'll move on. The bottom line conclusion for this court, I know, may I finish my last argument?
No, I'm going to keep you limited to your, but we do have the benefit of your brief, Mr. Burkholz.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Matter is submitted. That being the last matter on our oral case load for today, we are in recess.